Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Well, the debate on asylum seekers became a little clearer today as opposition leader Tony Abbott appeared on ABC TV's Insiders program. And despite the apparent failure of the parties to agree last week on a parliamentary solution to the continuing flow of refugee craft towards Christmas Island, the issue has not left the newspapers. And this evening, we're bringing together several leading church figures to tease out what is proving to be a test of both real politics and practical ethics. And still they come. Notwithstanding the expressed anguish of politicians and the hand-wringing of bureaucrats, policy remains frozen and lives continue to be lost as one boatload after another seeks the refuge of Christmas Island. Is it politics or principle that prevents a solution? Well, tonight we're going to take a look at the practical and ethical dimensions of the issue. It's a pleasure to welcome into the studio several of Australia's leading church spokespeople on the issue. The President of the Uniting Church, Reverend Dr. Alistair McRae. Alistair, good to have you with us.
Hello, John. Thank you.
Bishop Philip Huggins, the Anglican Assistant Bishop of Melbourne. Bishop Philip, welcome.
Good evening.
Alistair G is the Executive Director of Act for Peace, the International Aid and Refugee Agency of the National Council of Churches in Australia. Alistair?
Evening, John.
And we're also joined on the phone by Bishop Eugene Hurley, the Catholic Bishop of Darwin. Bishop Eugene, welcome to you.
Thank you very much, John.
Thanks for joining us. Now, whilst the position of the government and the opposition are similar in their view that offshore processing seems to be the only real deterrent to the continuing flow of boats, the precise nature of the opposition's view became a little clearer when Barry Cassidy spoke on Insiders this morning with opposition leader Tony Abbott. We shall hear a little more of that in a moment, but first let's briefly go through the various political positions as we understand them to be. Now, Alistair G, let me come to you first. As somebody who's looking for this from the point of view of the National Council of Churches, what's your official position on this? How does the National Council of Churches see this issue as it presents itself now, with the boats coming down and people screaming, stop, stop, stop? How do we stop them? Or should we stop them?
Well, the people screaming loudest to stop are the refugees themselves, and I think they would rather the issue was stopped a little earlier so they didn't have to flee home in the first place. But we certainly have to do more to prevent people from drowning at sea. And there are a number of things we can do. If it is that we have to go for the offshore-only processing that both the major parties are proposing, then there's certainly some things that need to be tightened up about
Has the National Council of Churches got an official position on this?
We do. We've got a range of things that we've been calling for many years in terms of increasing the refugee intake, doing more in Malaysia and Indonesia in terms of offering opportunities for refugees to come out. We're certainly against temporary protection visas. We're against turning boats back. We don't see the point of Nauru. And one other thing that we're very much for, which not many people are speaking about, are some very practical things that can be done in the few countries from which refugees are coming to Australia to reduce the levels of armed violence that are there.
Let's go to two of the larger churches that have put out statements on this issue in the past couple of weeks. Bishop Philip Huggins, you released a statement a couple of weeks ago before the latest contretemps, or right on the cusp of the latest contretemps, and we've seen more boats arrive since. How does the Anglican Church view this issue? And in this sense, was it a statement by you on the issue or something that reflected the formal opinion of the church?
Well, the statement came after that terrible incident where so many people drowned coming towards Christmas Island, and everybody, I think, right around the country was shocked and anguished by that, and it was the last sitting week of Parliament, and the parliamentarians were very focused on it as well, even though they didn't end up coming up with a solution. But essentially, that's what I was speaking out of, and that was consistent with the various resolutions of our synods and the like, that we really want to prevent any further unnecessary suffering and that we really need to seek better regional arrangements.
So the emphasis for you is on those regional arrangements?
Yes, I think so, and building trust in our region, building, it's a shared problem. No government, notwithstanding the way the debate is framed here in Australia, no government on its own can solve this. We have to do it cooperatively with other governments in our region, with the NGOs, with the United Nations, and there aren't really any simple solutions, so we've got to tackle it together and in the process build trust. Building trust is the key thing, and that should be a criterion by which we assess some of the statements from our parliamentarians.
Alistair McRae, as President of the Uniting Church, you're somebody who is looked to by the general public as a spokesperson for the church. The Uniting Church put out a statement on the issue as this current crisis unfolded. What was your response to the way things then took off in Parliament, or didn't take off?
Well, it was a little bit perplexing to see such a high level of emotional engagement of our leaders, but producing no solution that we would find acceptable. We're committed. Our baseline position is that we really want to return to have onshore processing, just not push people away and have them processed in places that are less competent to do it and less able to do it. But neither do we want people putting their lives at risk by coming across on these boats. So in the interim, increase our humanitarian intake quite significantly. Explore the regional approach to the whole thing and maybe invest more resources in places like Indonesia and Malaysia to humanise the conditions that they're being kept in and to keep people safe. And then increase the speed of our resettlement of asylum seekers once they come to Australia.
Bishop Eugene Hurley in Darwin, you're somebody who's... to use a general description, on the front line of the problem. You've had something to do with what's happened at Christmas Island. Do you think Australians are appreciative enough of the human dimension of what's happening?
I think it's easy, John, to fall into the trap of labelling people. And once we label people, mentally it's much easier for us to dismiss them as either not important or not requiring any further... anything from us. We've labelled them, we've got them as queue jumpers or terrorists or something that enables us not to deal with them as human beings. And the Australian Catholic Bishops at a recent meeting restated that asylum seekers should be detained only as a last resort for the shortest possible time, and that must be held in conditions that ensure their human dignity. That's wherever they are, and there are millions across the world, and we only deal with just a tiny trickle here. I know that it's significant for us, but most of the illegal arrivals in our country are not by boat at all. A very small percentage comes by boat, a little more in recent times, but most arrive by air, and very few of those are in detention. They're being processed in the community while they await an outcome. But we seem to have an obsession with the numbers that arrive by boat, which are probably the most vulnerable of all the asylum seekers, really.
Could I ask you all to comment on this one issue? The Greens have maintained a position that, ideally, I think many churches have expressed a view that they're sympathetic with. That is, that onshore processing should be the preferred option, that we should be a more welcoming community, and that the flood of refugees, albeit we see it as a flood in Australian terms, is nothing more than a trickle compared to what many other countries around the world are absorbing as a matter of course. And that for us to stand and say that the hordes are coming, the floods are coming, is somewhat delusional in world terms. Yet nevertheless, it seems that the real politics of the situation determine that the Greens and people who support that position are standing somewhere in political no man's land. That is, the pure are impotent, to quote the well-known political cliche, that it's not a sustainable position given the political reality of Australia at the moment. How do you respond to that, Alistair McRae?
Yeah, if I might just comment, I don't think we can say too often, put the international perspective on this. I read yesterday that there's 43.7 million forcibly displaced people around the globe at the moment. There's 15 million refugees. And in 2009, 632,000 people were processed and determined as refugees worldwide, of which 3,400 were in Australia. That's 0.5% were here.
See, while you give me that figure, some people would say, isn't that shocking? Other people would say, see, we can't have a flood like that descending on our shores.
Well, I think the point is that it's not a flood. We're a very wealthy country.
But we risk a flood.
Well, I really don't think we do risk a flood. I mean, even if we took all the people waiting in Indonesia and all the people in Malaysia, it still would not constitute a flood.
Yeah, there really aren't that many people waiting in Indonesia. There's 4,000 registered with UNHCR. Most of the people who are waiting in Malaysia, of which there's about 80,000, are from Western Burma. The numbers who are actually trying or thinking about coming to Australia are those from Afghanistan, Iraq, Sri Lanka, the main countries that have then hopped on boats to Australia, aren't big numbers in Malaysia. So there's certainly not a tsunami of people building up in our region waiting to come here. And where I think the Greens have a big problem is, at least they've been perceived to say the emphasis or the preference should be on onshore protection, whereas we could invest a whole lot more on onshore assessment. We could invest a whole lot more on offshore assessment to make it work so that people don't feel that they have a need to hop on the boats. We do, though, I think, need to recognise that both the major parties are determined to proceed with offshore processing, and I think it's to UNHCR's credit that they have sought to become involved and, I think, turned what would have otherwise been a pretty ordinary Malaysia deal into something which has some protections written into it, albeit that they are just guidelines, they're non-binding, so obviously it's not nearly as good as it really needs to be. But the fact that they didn't just walk away is very important to that process, and I think generally something we should listen a lot more to. If UNHCR, who's responsible for these 43 million people around the world and is the agency set up to advise on how to stop people from drowning, if we listen to them, they have a few answers on this, and they've also always maintained Australia should keep the onshore processing option open.
Bishop Philip Huggins, how does the church respond to the real politic of this issue? I mean, the Australian electorate, it seems, simply will not cop an argument about onshore processing, whatever its virtues are at the moment. Does that mean that the churches should stand and support the onshore position and risk the impotence of irrelevance, or should the churches move towards some sort of view that accommodates what the political reality is?
Well, as you said in your introduction, we do actually have a very noble history. We've been very generous at receiving refugees and asylum seekers really all through since World War II. We've noticed how wonderfully well they've settled, what a wonderful contribution they make to our nation. I think there's an acknowledgement of that right through the Australian community, and therefore a nobler intent. I think in terms of your question, we don't need to go down the path we're going. We're capable of something much nobler. And my encouragement would still be, we would like to see the Prime Minister and Leader of the Opposition meet privately and quietly with Mr. Minister Bowen and Scott Morrison and their advisers and come up with a solution, a bipartisan solution. As you said in your your introduction, there was a time when this was a bipartisan matter. We recognised ourselves as international citizens and that we had a contribution to make. We made a generous contribution and we did it in a bipartisan way. That is part of our Australian story, and that's the part we need to remember and retell.
Bishop Eugene Hurley, are you concerned that that notion of Australia is moved off the table, and if the churches maintain that position, they risk irrelevance on this issue in terms of the public debate?
Oh, I think that there's a, a misconception about what the Australian public think. The interesting thing is that all the people that I introduce to refugees and asylum seekers are people who then become passionate advocates. Until then, they've been living in a misty sense of some unrealistic profile of the people. I live here in Darwin, where the Timorese came here seeking asylum, as you might remember, just a few years ago, really. And when I visit Timor, the people there are just so grateful and love Australia and Australians so much because of the compassionate way that they were received here. They were looked after. They were treated with respect. And we have a big Timorese community here now. Many of them went back. A lot of them are here. And it makes me feel enormously proud as an Australian to have that image. And, you know, my father came from another country to this country. What he taught me was to love it with a passion. I think I do that. And one of the things I love about it was the opportunity it gave my father and the opportunity it gave the people who were so traumatized coming from Timor to Darwin. Many of the Vietnamese that came here by boat, two of them are priests in my diocese. I'm just so pleased that those boats weren't turned around. And I suppose it's the old thing, if you... I try not to judge until I know the story. And then my experience is when I know the story, I've never felt like judging. I've felt full of compassion, but I've never felt that I had the right to judge.
Well, let's look at the real politic for a moment as it stands, as the battle stands before us. The Greens seem to be isolated on one point, saying onshore processing, and people say, yes, that's morally the good thing, but politically it's not in the game at the moment. You've got the government and the opposition. The government saying, yes, we'll agree with Nauru, and maybe we can talk about TPVs, but we also want a regional solution encompassing sort of Malaysia in the mix. The opposition are saying, no, it's just Nauru and perhaps TPVs or nothing. It seems the standoff, though, becomes very difficult because the government's position is one which they need the opposition's vote to get a Malaysian solution up. The opposition are saying no because they're not signatories. The Human Rights Convention, they can't have it. On the other hand, the Nauru solution seems to be difficult because people are now saying, and these are people in the Immigration Department, no, Nauru is now recognised as just a staging post to Australia because those who went to Nauru eventually got to Australia, so it has no deterrent value. And the politics of TPVs are difficult for both sides because they result in horrible news journalists racing out and getting pictures of people locked up in camps sewing their lips together. So we seem to be stuck in a position that leads none of us anywhere. Today, on Australian television, Tony Abbott gave one of his few interviews recently to the ABC on this issue, and he spoke with Barry Cassidy on what seems to be really the nub of the solution for deterrence if Nauru and TPVs don't work for the opposition, and that was turning the boats back. Let's hear what Barry Cassidy and Tony Abbott had to say this morning on the Insiders program.
Clearly turning back the boats will impact on our relationship with Indonesia. Why did you not discuss this issue with President Yudhoyono when you met him this week?
Well, I don't talk about what I discussed with President Yudhoyono, Barry, and this is one of the problems that the government has got. They're more interested in making heroes of themselves in the media than building a good relationship with Indonesia.
No, but it's clear that you didn't discuss it with him. Now why did you not discuss it? Is it because you were troubled about what he might say?
Again, I'm not going to say what I did and didn't discuss with the president. But the fact is, if we're talking about the issue of turning boats around, it's been done before. It can be done again.
But if that's your view, why not be upfront with him? I mean, you've got an opportunity. You're sitting across from him. Why would you not raise it with him?
Well, as now, I said, you shouldn't assume
My sources are pretty good. Well, you did not raise this issue with him.
Well, the fact is, Barry, Indonesia knows exactly what our position is. They know exactly what our position is. They know that on day one of an incoming coalition government, the Navy will be given new orders to deal with illegal boat arrivals and with safety at sea.
They don't like that policy.
And I accept that from time to time, Australia will do things that the Indonesians don't particularly like. The difference between a government I lead and the current government is I won't be playing this for media advantage, and I will try to have a no surprises policy with the Indonesians, where at least we tell them well in advance what we've got in mind.
A no surprises policy. You had an opportunity to talk to him about it and you didn't.
Well, it's not as if the Indonesians are in ignorance as to what the coalition intends.
How would it work? A boat turns up on the horizon, you locate the boat. What happens then?
It'll work the same way in the future that it's worked in the past. And let's never forget, Barry, that Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard are both on the record at different times supporting the policy of turning around boats.
But how does it work, though? You locate the boat, as I said. You take away fuel and food or something to make it difficult for them to carry on?
It's the same as it worked in the past.
Well, remind us of how that
was.
Well,
I'm not going to go into those sorts of details. But
it was critical. I mean, tell us how it works.
And various naval commanders have explained all this in great detail before Senate Estimates Committee and elsewhere. But it was done in the past, it can be done in the future.
But why can't you give us a sense of how it actually works?
Well, because you've just begun to give us a sense of that, Barry, and we've had this explained to us by the naval commanders, and I don't want to be setting myself up as a modern-day Captain Hornblower.
Yeah, and one of those was Admiral Chris Barry, and he doesn't like it. He thinks it's dangerous, both for the Navy and for the asylum seekers.
And I'm not saying that this is particularly pleasant work. It is a very tough job.
Dangerous work.
Yes, it's dangerous work, but that's why people join our armed forces. They go into harm's way to help our country.
But you conceded it's dangerous, then why go through with it?
Because it's less dangerous all round than these boats taking to sea. You see, as long as the boats keep coming, the tragedies will keep happening. And the great thing about turning the boats around is that it sends the clearest possible signal to the people smugglers and their customers, the game is up. The game is up. And that's the best possible way to stop the boats.
And I still don't see, though, if you take away the fuel, for example, they just keep going until they run out of fuel, and then it's Australia's obligation to rescue them.
Well, as I said, Barry, it's been done in the past. The professionalism of the Navy was up to it in the past. I have no doubt that the Navy is just as professional now as it was in 2001.
And then they end up in Indonesia. Indonesia is not a signatory to the conventions. What's the difference between that and sending them to Malaysia?
Well, they put themselves in Indonesia.
But they still end up in a country. You're allowing them to end up in a country that's not a signatory to the convention.
That they put themselves in.
It's their fault.
Well, they put themselves in Indonesia. They didn't put themselves in Malaysia.
Opposition leader Tony Abbott appearing on this morning's Insiders program with Barry Cassidy. Well, Barry Cassidy went on to ask his panel, including journalist David Ma, who's written a book on the issue with Marion Wilkinson called Dark Victory, how Ma's response to what Tony Abbott observed.
David, after listening to that interview, are you more or less convinced that turning back the boats will work?
Well, work to do what? If you want to stop boats coming, and there's a whole question about why we want to stop boats coming. You know, we're not being invaded, we're not being overrun. Yes, they're quite large numbers at the moment, but you know, this is what happens in a lot of countries around the world. If you want to stop the boats, pushing them back is the way to do it. It worked in 2001. At least three asylum seekers drowned during those operations. They were incredibly dangerous for the Navy. What they do, by the way, Barry, is they take the women and kids off, they put a boarding party on, the Navy steers the boat to the edge of Indonesian waters, they give it just enough petrol to get to land, they put the women and the children back on, and that's its only alternative, is to go to land. But the problem with this is, apart from it being brutal and dangerous, is that the Indonesians are not going to accept it. This is a fantasy. There is a fantasy going on here that somehow or other the wishes of the Indonesians can be ignored in all of this. They have been absolutely emphatic. They will not allow boats to be pushed back.
And they take the view that these are not Indonesians anyway, so why are they particularly their responsibility? They're people, asylum seekers, who have transited through Indonesia with a clear target, Australia, in mind. Mm.
That's right.
Journalist David Maher with Barry Cassidy on this morning's Insiders program. What's our ethical response to what we've just heard? Philip Huggins.
Well, the first thing, I think, when the phrase is used that these people choose to be Indonesia, it, as Bishop Eugene was saying, it completely stereotypes what is a tragic circumstance of people having to flee their homeland because of forces outside of their control to try and find refuge in some other place. So to talk about them as having chosen to be in Indonesia is really most inappropriate. Secondly, too, it's trying to find a simple solution to a very complex issue. And as David Maher was saying there at the end, what would that be like for the Indonesians and thus for our relationship with Indonesia? We do have to build trust in our region. This is a shared problem, one that we all have to tackle together. We need a very positive relationship with the Indonesian government, with UNHCR, with the Thai government, with the Malaysian government, to come up with solutions together for what is a shared problem. Simplifying it to something as brutal and crude as that is really completely unhelpful.
Bishop Eugene Hurley, your response?
Yes, I think it comes over as pretty tough rhetoric, and I guess that has some appeal, but it certainly bears analysis, and I thought that David Maher analysed it very well indeed. To be honest, I'm not that obsessed with boats, whether we turn them around or sink them or whatever we want to do with them, but what I am immensely concerned about is that the boats that we refer to are full of human beings, people whose story I do not know, but I'm convinced that they're usually very vulnerable people fleeing from unimaginable sufferings. And what happens to them in all this political tomfoolery is my concern, and certainly the concern of the Australian Catholic bishops, to be playing with the lives of vulnerable people who have a perfect right to seek asylum in our country, to which we are signatories to international covenants to that effect, just seems to me to be crass.
What would you say to Tony Abbott if you had the opportunity?
Well, I'd say to Tony exactly what I've said. I think that I'm not obsessed with boats. If they want to turn them around, that's perfectly fine. But they need to be mightily aware that the boats are not the point, that they're full of people, and that we have an international responsibility. We're signatories to international covenants, apart from the fact that I would have thought any reasonable Australian's point of view, that human beings are much more important than having a few boats arrive, and particularly people of the nature that fill these boats.
Alistair McRae, were there any issues that struck you there listening to both those conversations?
Oh, I just agree entirely with the two previous respondents that the challenge here is to humanise the whole situation. I think that the language of boats and illegals and all this sort of thing.
But what about this very specific digging Barry Cassidy went to on the issue of just actually what do you do?
Yeah.
What are you requiring naval personnel to do?
Yeah, what are the mechanics of turning back? That was a really good line of questioning. But I just think we've just got to I've been to Christmas Island twice recently, visited detention centres and heard stories. And as Eugene said, as soon as you hear people's stories, you realise what they've left, the vulnerability that they're facing, and I don't know. I found Mr. Abbott's response incredibly clinical and cold, and I think that narrative needs to be challenged by all Australians with beating hearts.
Alistair G.
Yeah, I remember giving evidence about interdictions at sea to a Senate committee back over 10 years ago, a time when not too many people seemed interested on that aspect. There were plenty of other big issues in asylum going on in Australia, such as about detention. And I'm glad that people are really now understanding what it is about. Though one of the things that particularly struck me about what Mr. Abbott had said was that they chose to be in Indonesia, therefore it's okay to take them back to the borders with Indonesia. It's not their choice to be able to stay in Indonesia. Indonesia, as we are all reminded, is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, something that doesn't particularly trouble me. But the point is, for each of those refugees on whichever boat we're talking about, they would have been living in Indonesia without work rights, without a permit to say they can stay. They would have been at risk of being sent or being expelled from Indonesia at any time, with very little support from UNHCR and some of the very few NGOs that might be able to assist them if they can be found. So they very much become Australia's problem. And again, talking of loaded language, that is not language I should use. They become Australia's responsibility the second they come into Australia's territory, because they haven't had effective protection in Indonesia or likely in any other country that they have transited on their way here. So once we have them, they are our responsibility. If we want to take them back to Indonesia, we have to make sure they have protection when they go back there, and that is clearly not having happened. If we have been able to craft such a... put so much thought into how to turn a boat back, hopefully we can put some thought into how to find protection for those people. And the same has to be said for the Malaysian deal and the legislation that Mr. Oakeshott and has put up, and the bill that was debated in Parliament. There is nothing in that legislation which says that the Parliament must, or that Australia can only send people to an offshore processing country if they're rights are going to be respected and they are going to have some level of protection while they wait there. And that is the fundamental problem.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio, around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Our guests this Sunday night are the President of the Uniting Church of Australia, the Reverend Dr. Alistair McRae, Bishop Philip Huggins, Anglican Assistant Bishop in Melbourne, Alistair G, the Executive Director of Act for Peace, the International Aid and Refugee Agency of the National Council of Churches in Australia, and also on the line, Bishop Eugene Hurley, the Catholic Bishop of Darwin. And we'll take your calls, 1-300-800-222, 1-300-800-222. And Ross is on the line from Sydney. Hello, Ross, how are you?
Hi, John.
Thanks for joining us. What would you like to say?
I've just been following this for a couple of years now, and look, I'm just really concerned that, and I think it's time that good people started to speak up about Tony Abbott and his, and that real right-wing neocon, basically fascist side of the so-called Liberal Party that's been really enabled in this by the mainstream media, in collusion with the mainstream media, which I believe to be fairly corrupt around issues like this and other things that have been going on with this man Abbott and his extreme views.
What would your resolution be? What's your preferred option?
Look, this has been my view for a long time. I see myself as a reasonable individual. We follow the covenants of the United Nations and Australian law and process all refugees and asylum seekers in community in Australia.
But it's not going to happen politically. Both political parties...
it's got to happen, you know.
It won't. I might agree with you ideally, but we're living in a real world and there's an election coming up in 12 months' time.
Well, what do you think the answer is?
Well,
we've just got to, as the gentleman was saying, we've just got to try and educate people out there as to the reality of this. And perhaps the mainstream media might come around and, which basically is controlled by a criminal in this country, Rupert Murdoch, okay?
Well, potentially, and it hasn't come to that yet. So let's avoid the defamation lawyers, shall we? I think we've got your position, Ross. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
All the best. Bye. Let's go to Tony in Caloundra. Hello, Tony. Your opinion.
Good evening, gentlemen. What an august group of people we have on the air tonight. I'd just like to say why don't we have a referendum and see how many people in Australia actually want to have all these asylum seekers? Everybody that I know don't want them. And they're only a bunch of people that are trying to queue jump anyway from genuine refugees. And they ought to be put right back on the end of the queue where they belong. If they're all worried about sending them back to Indonesia, send them back to their home country. That's the easiest situation. If you're going to let people in here that are genuine refugees and you've got men of military age, they shouldn't be immediately trained and sent back to fight for their country, like Australians do. We fight for our country, and we fight for every other bloody country in the world. We need people here with courage to fight for their country, and if they don't belong here, they belong fighting for their country.
Alistair G, your response to what's just been observed by Tony.
Thank you for the call, Tony. All these people are assessed against the same criteria. It doesn't matter whether you've hopped on a boat to get somewhere, you've hopped on a bus. Everyone has made some trip to get somewhere. In terms of having a referendum in Australia, I think we'd actually find that while a lot of people are against boat people for one reason or another, Australia is extremely supportive of having refugees. When these surveys have been done, we have the highest sort of support rates of anywhere in the world, and I think we've also got some of the best policies and best evidence of refugees having made a contribution to Australia. And if we had sent them all back, we would have missed out on what has been found to be a net gain for this country. Refugees resettled here over the last three generations have worked harder, studied longer, and done more community contribution, volunteering, than the average Australian. So Australia would certainly be worse off.
Thanks for your contribution, Tony. We must move on. Lots of calls on the board to David in Baden in the ACT. Hello, David. What would you like to know?
Hi, yes. Well, it's really a question. I'm wondering what the basis in international law is for Australia turning a boat around in international waters.
It's an interesting question that was raised in that piece with Barry Cassidy and Tony Abbott. Alistair McRae.
I'm not an international lawyer, I'm afraid, but I think to physically engage another vessel in international waters, that there must be some legal issues around that.
Yes, and I guess it was when both Tony Abbott and David Marr alluded to this, stopping the boats on the high seas, taking people onto the Australian vessels, then taking off those vessels sufficient fuel to prevent them travelling any further than the next coast. And you would have to wonder, I guess that's the point that people would wonder, hang on.
Isn't that piracy?
Yeah, that's a good point.
People die in the process, isn't that manslaughter?
And there is an internationally recognised legal right to seek asylum. Yeah, that's right. A legal right.
Well, we don't know the answer, but you've certainly raised what I guess a number of people will be asking, David, over the next few days. Thanks for your call. All the best. To Glenn in Castle Hill. Hello, Glenn. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you guys?
Yeah, good. What would you like to say?
Look, I just made the point. I understand that your hearts are all in the right place, but I think we're forgetting a number of items. One is, for every refugee we're bringing in from the Middle East, we're not bringing in people from Africa and some of those poor, poverty-stricken places around the world. Also, too, these people are coming on passports, flying into Indonesia. When they get to Indonesia, then paying the corrupt Indonesian officials to get on a boat and throwing their passports. And all us Australians, all us people are saying, oh, you poor thing. These people are nothing like we've had in the past with the Vietnamese and a whole bunch of other people who are genuine refugees. And the final third point, Western Sydney has been destroyed by people of Arabic origin. I know that sounds racist, but let's be honest. Every bikie, every drug lab, every drive-by shooting is connected to the Arab community. These people are coming over in boatloads. They're all going on the dole. They're all having, you know, a whole bunch of different benefits in this country. And they're laughing at us. Back in their own country, they're saying, get to Australia very quickly, because you're going to get the dole, you're going to get a housing commission house. Mate, it is paradise.
Bishop Philip Huggins, your response to the observation there from Glenn.
in relation to...
Well, his first point, perhaps, not so much the infiltration of Western Sydney, but his point.
I think what the history shows us is that people come traumatised from whatever their experience has been in their homeland has forced them to flee. It takes three generations, really, for them to be healed of the trauma, to settle, to get their family ordered and organised. It's very important if they can have family reunion. But then, as we've seen, whether they've come from Africa, whether they've come from the Middle East, or whether they've come from Asia, they turn into outstanding Australian citizens who make a significant contribution to the well-being and the flourishing of our common wealth. So we need to support the people when they come here, when they're vulnerable, and give them the opportunity to then make their contribution to our national well-being. And we need to keep the whole thing in perspective. As has been said through our program, the number of people we take in relation to the number who are desperately seeking asylum and refugee status is quite small, but generous by international standards. We're well able to manage it. We really need to take the heat out of this issue, the way we're framing it. We're such a blessed country. We've got so many wonderful advantages. Wonderful. We should be replacing the people of Bhutan as the happiest people in the world, but we keep framing ourselves into these crisis-ridden conversations, these stressed conversations, and we're stripping ourselves of our own capacity to enjoy all that we are and all that we have.
Alistair G.
Yeah, it didn't used to be the case that someone coming to Australia and claiming asylum would take the place of someone on the humanitarian program, such as from Africa. That came about with the Howard government linked the two programs. We've been asking from the day they did it that they undo it, because it creates this false sense of competition. One reason that it's very important that we maintain an asylum system and deal fairly with whoever actually reaches our shores and claims asylum is it's a very delicate balance in the international system. As the other Alistair was saying before, there's 43 million refugees around the world. It means there are 43 million people in other countries. A lot of them are in countries that have more than a million refugees currently in there, and they are barely able to cope. And not too many of those countries want to have a million refugees in their country. Countries like Pakistan, flood over from Afghanistan, they would love, and they have at times, closed the doors and said, no more, we're pushing you back. It's only because of this solidarity that every country, or so many countries, says, we are going to take whoever comes here who needs our protection. We'll make sure that there is some... We'll keep them here until there's some solution for them. And if Australia and other small countries start shutting the door, then we've got big problems with countries like Pakistan doing the same.
We're nearly out of time, but I just want to go a brief round and just see if there is any way through what's currently presented. We've got Nauru and turning the boats back and TPVs by the opposition. We've got the Malaysian solution offered by the government in conjunction with Nauru. If you're sitting down in a real political discussion with the leaders and you've got to work something through, do you think there is a common way through, and what would you say? We'll start with Philip Huggins in Melbourne. Bishop Philip Huggins, what would you say in a sort of 1 minute summary?
What I would say, I would love to see the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition invite the leaders of the nations we've named from Indonesia, Thailand, Singapore and the like to have a meeting together, to share this problem that we all have together, and see what can come up as a resolution in a bipartisan manner.
That's a regional solution approach. Bishop Eugene Hurley in Darwin, how would you see the resolution?
Yes, I'd be very keen to support Bishop Philip Huggins there. I suppose with my absolute brutal political hat on, I guess we can never let the perfect become the enemy of the possible. We have people drowning in unseaworthy vessels at the moment coming. That, I think, has to be a principle that we have to protect human life, so that we begin at that point and take a humanitarian attitude to that. And so whatever might come from a suitable and rational discussion as outlined, I think we must look carefully to preserving life. And if that's not perfect, what we come up with, let's build on that till we get the perfect. But to walk away leaving people drowning as if that were politically acceptable, I find, as I've said before, just to be on the verge of obscene.
Alistair G, 45 seconds.
All right. Well, the whole debate seems to be about two words in Section 198A2 of the Migration Act, whether it says Bali Process or Refugee Convention, as to the country to choose. If you make it about six extra words about that country providing protection to the people you send there, then you might just have something that's workable. Involve the UNHCR. At the moment, there's no protections in terms of the Oakeshott Bill, and that needs to be fixed. Generally, UNHCR will be able to guide us to a workable solution.
Alistair McRae, the final word. We should say this may be your final opportunity as National President of the United Church to address the nation.
My final presidential ruling. I think it just, I won't repeat any of the previous words, which were all very, very wise, but I think I'd just make the more general appeal to Australian citizens to recall the best parts of our character and our history. We've received into this country since the Second World War 650,000 refugees who've greatly enriched our life, and I think we just need to remind ourselves of the best of who we are and turn away from this meanness.
Alistair McRae, retiring President of the United Church of Australia, thank you for joining us. To our other guests, Bishop Philip Huggins, Anglican Assistant Bishop of Melbourne, Alistair G, the Executive Director of Act for Peace, the International Aid Agency of the National Council of Churches of Australia, and also Catholic Bishop Eugene Hurley of Darwin. Thank you all so much for joining us on Sunday night, and doubtless this conversation will continue. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.